On the evening of June 18, 1984, Alan Berg pulled into the driveway of his Denver, Colorado home. He'd been out to dinner with his estranged wife. Berg wasn't the easiest man to live with. He'd battled alcoholism, a brain tumor, and lingering seizures. His temper sometimes got the best of him. As a late-night radio talk show host, Alan Berg channeled most of his energy into the show. Berg encountered all kinds of people on the other end of the line, and he argued with many of them. Those who really got under his skin, he berated with sarcasm and insults. That earned him admirers and enemies. Berg was Jewish, and among those he reserved special disdain for were anti-Semites, white supremacists, and neo-Nazis, some of whom were members of a secret society known as the Order. That evening, the Order was waiting for him. As Berg got out of his car, he was mowed down by a hail of bullets. The killer or killers got away. Berg's assassination was only one of many crimes allegedly committed by the Order in little over a year's time, beginning with the robbery of a Spokane, Washington porn shop and graduating to a $3.6 million armored car heist. The Order also dabbled at counterfeiting, which proved the organization's downfall. A member was caught passing phony 50s, and the feds turned him into an informant. By December 1984, the FBI had rounded up most of the group and cornered the Order's founder, Robert Matthews, in his Whidbey Island, Washington farmhouse. Matthews refused to surrender and died in a fiery shootout with 75 federal agents. More than 70 Order members and associates were convicted of crimes, though none for Alan Berg's murder. The best the feds could do was to convict two Order brothers, David Lane and Bruce Pierce, for violating Berg's civil rights. This is the last lecture in a series exploring the history, organization, and impact of secret societies. I hesitate to call it a conclusion because where secret societies are concerned, there is no conclusion. They've existed since the beginnings of human society, and will continue to exist. They're an integral part of the human experience. I can't tell you how it all ends, because it hasn't. What I will do is roll out some final examples that reinforce some common characteristics of secret societies. One of them is that there's usually a charismatic or visionary individual whose inspiration or leadership is essential to the society's creation. Without this individual, the group wouldn't exist. In the example of the medieval assassins of Persia, that individual was Hassan i-Sabah. With the Bavarian Illuminati, it was Adam Weishaupt. With the Bolsheviks, Vladimir Lenin. In the Society of the Elect, it was Cecil Rhodes. And with the Great Eleven of 1920s Los Angeles, May Blackburn. The founding leader of the Order was Robert J. Matthews. Like others, Matthews wasn't only inspiring, but inspired. Secret society leaders have almost always had a vision of their group's past and its future. The visions may be bogus or unrealistic, but they become the justification for a group's existence. Let's take a closer look at Robert Matthews. There's nothing particularly notable about his family or upbringing. Matthews moved from Texas to Arizona as a boy. The first hint of something out of the ordinary comes in 1964, when 11-year-old Robert joined the rigorously conservative and fiercely anti-communist John Birch Society. The Birch Society isn't associated with violence, but it was an odd thing for an 11-year-old kid to dedicate himself to. Matthews didn't know it, but he'd started on a path that would end in that burning house on Whidbey Island. In high school, Matthews joined the Mormon Church. It also was during high school that he formed his own secret society, the Sons of Liberty. Matthews borrowed the name of a patriotic secret order from the American Revolution. That's another pattern, new secret societies cannibalizing or copying old ones. Matthews' Sons of Liberty attracted 50 members before it fell apart. Yet another common pattern. Robert Matthews was clearly a joiner. He was also a reader. One book that grabbed his attention was Which Way Western Man by William G. Simpson. Simpson started out as a devout Christian and director of what became the Liberal American Civil Liberties Union. But in the 1930s, Simpson repudiated Christianity and liberalism. He came to believe that race was the dominant factor in human affairs. Simpson restyled himself a white nationalist and argued that violence in defense of the white race was justified. It fits that old saying, to the pure, all things are pure. But the book that really lit a fire under Matthews was The Turner Diaries, published in 1978. Its author, William Luther Pierce, ran a white nationalist society called the National Alliance. In his day job, Pierce was a physicist. The Turner Diaries was a novel. It was set in a future dystopian America in which the government had collapsed and race war raged. Its heroes are white Christian patriots who eventually triumph and purge the world of their enemies. In the Turner Diaries, Robert Matthews found his vision. He joined the National Alliance. By 1983, Matthews was living in Medellin, Washington. In September of that year, he invited 8 other like-minded young men to his home. They pledged to form a new order to fight for the white race. In homage to the Nazis, Matthews and his comrades officially dubbed their group the Bruderschweigen, or Silent Brotherhood. Outwardly, it was known as the Order. Robert Matthews' career as a secret society leader was brief and bloody. But it didn't really end with his death. In the white supremacist universe, he became a martyr and a source of new inspiration. One of those he inspired was Timothy McVeigh, perpetrator of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. Robert Matthews is symptomatic of a pattern repeated over and over. To drive the point home, I want to look at 3 other men, all of them American, and all masterminds of radical right clandestine organizations. Similarities aside, the story of each of these men is unique. Their careers also point out the virus-like quality of secret societies, the constant recycling and recombination of elements into new or not-so-new forms. The first case we'll examine emerges in 2011 in the American South. Georgia police found the bodies of 2 young people, 19-year-old Michael Rourke and 17-year-old Tiffany York, dumped along a road. Both had been shot execution style. Investigation led to the arrests of 4 young men. All turned out to be members of a secret militant group called Forever Enduring, Always Ready, FEAR for short. Catchy, huh? More curious, the 4, along with the murdered Rourke and most of their other associates, were current or past members of the U.S. Army. The ringleader was an Army private named Isaac Agigi. Agigi and his associates killed Rourke and York because they feared that the couple would betray the group. FEAR took their oaths of secrecy very seriously. Among other things, they were planning to blow up dams, assassinate the president, and overthrow the U.S. government. There also was more mundane criminal activity. The most glaring example involved the sudden death in July 2011 of Isaac Agigi's pregnant wife, an Army sergeant. She supposedly died from a blood clot. In fact, Agigi murdered her and his unborn son to collect $500,000 in insurance. FEAR was planning similar murders, while they also engaged in theft, weapon smuggling, and probably drug dealing. They needed money to buy land in Washington State, Robert Matthews' old base of operations. There, Agigi and his comrades planned to build a secret army that would take over the country. They even had a target date, 2031. If this sounds like a juvenile fantasy, it was. But in true secret society tradition, FEAR members took oaths, got matching tattoos, and adopted code names. Agigi's was Loki. They also had inspiration. It all started with bored young men playing video games. In this case, it was Rainbow Six. The game featured an heroic militia group, the Patriots, who battle forces of oppression. But Agigi and pals weren't just ordinary bored young men. They were soldiers. They had access to weapons, and they knew how to use them. Most of them were disgruntled soldiers with troubled pasts. Agigi's military experience hadn't lived up to his expectations. A history of disciplinary infractions was common among FEAR members. These were young men with chips on their shoulders. In some countries, they might have plotted a coup d'etat. In the United States, they created a terrorist criminal secret society. For our next example, we need to go back several decades. The man in question is William Dudley Pelley. His career included stints as a Hollywood screenwriter, religious mystic, UFO contactee, and would-be American Führer. Born in 1890, Pelley grew up poor and self-educated. A knack for writing drew him to journalism. By the time of World War I, Pelley was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. In 1918, Pelley traveled to Vladivostok, Russia, where he got a first-hand look at Bolshevism. It turned him into a lifelong anti-communist. He also encountered Jews among the Siberian Bolsheviks. Some of them were Americans, and Pelley began to imagine a Jewish plot in the Russian Revolution. So began Pelley's drift into anti-Semitism. Back in the States, Pelley ended up in Hollywood. Between 1919 and 1929, he was a writer on many films. He rubbed elbows with silent stars Lon Chaney, Tom Mix, Mary Astor, and Hoot Gibson, among others. Pelley also penned short stories and novels, two of which he adapted for the screen. Pelley's Hollywood days weren't all tinsel and sunshine. He had a writer's usual conflicts with studio management, and among the studio execs were Jews who fed his anti-Semitic suspicions. But there were other things brewing in William Dudley Pelley. Again, Pelley was a seeker. One night in 1928, Pelley had what we'd call today an out-of-body experience. He described it as best he could in the book 7 Minutes in Eternity. Pelley left the Hollywood rat race and moved to Asheville, North Carolina. There, he soaked up mystical doctrines including Rosicrucianism, theosophy, and pyramid power. He started his own magazine, The New Liberator, in which he promoted spiritualism, reincarnation, anti-Semitism, and Christian economics. Basically, the do-unto-others philosophy applied to capitalism. Pelley dabbled in telepathy, levitation, and automatic writing. Pelley also claimed to have contact with theosophy's ascended masters, the advanced spiritual beings in the Himalayas who supposedly guided the destiny of the world. That led him into politics, or what Pelley called social metaphysics. His next big revelation was the emergence of Adolf Hitler as leader of Germany in 1933. Pelley saw Hitler as a kindred spirit and a model for the role Pelley felt destined to play in America. By now, Pelley was convinced that Jews were dark souls responsible for most of the world's evils. So, in 1933, he formed the Silver Legion of America. Its members wore, what else, silver shirts emblazoned with a scarlet letter L. By 1935, the silver shirts numbered about 15,000 people nationwide. Of course, Pelley's was only one of at least 100 imitation Nazi groups across America. An especially active chapter of the Silver Shirts held court in Pelley's old Hollywood stomping grounds. Actor Errol Flynn may have been a member. The Silver Legion's doctrine was anti-FDR, anti-New Deal, and anti-Jew. Although outwardly a political movement, the Legion was at heart a secret society. Membership was selective, white Christians only, and there were insignia, rituals, and oaths. Pelley promised his silver shirts they would become the new elite in a future Christian commonwealth. Pelley's legion also embodied his mystical doctrines, though most members were only dimly aware of that. To generate mass appeal, Pelley created the Christian Party. He was its candidate for president in 1936, but got on the ballot in only one state and garnered fewer than 2,000 votes. Like his mortal enemies, the communists, Pelle rode the wave of discontent generated by the Depression. As that waned, so did his support. By 1939, Silver Shirt membership had dropped below 5,000. But William Pelle didn't give up. He forged alliances with the pro-Nazi German-American Bund, and even with the Ku Klux Klan. He consorted with known Axis agents such as George Sylvester Viereck and Boris Brasov. Pelle has even been accused of masterminding the construction of a secret Nazi base in the hills above Los Angeles. In some version, this secluded hideaway was to be a guest house for Hitler after he won the war and moved to Hollywood. This so-called Murphy Ranch tale is so strange and has so many secret society currents running through it that it deserves some explanation. Like many urban legends, it has a core of truth embedded in a lot of imaginative fiction. The secret base, or whatever it was, actually existed, though it was never completed. Its graffiti-covered ruins can still be visited today, hidden off Rustic Canyon, a couple of miles from Santa Monica and the Getty Museum, and right next to Will Rogers State Park. In fact, the ranch property was purchased from Will Rogers. It wasn't a ranch in the usual sense. It was a large house with its own water supply, power plant, swimming pool, barns, and greenhouses, all surrounded by a barbed wire fence. Think off-the-grid living. Pelle's name is usually roped in because of claims that in the 1930s, the property was patrolled by men wearing silver shirts. Regardless, someone obviously wanted their privacy. In public records, the formal buyer was a Jesse Murphy, hence Murphy's Ranch. The actual purchasers and builders were a wealthy Pasadena couple, Norman and Winona Stevens. They bought the land using Jesse Murphy as a front. That might suggest that the Stevenses had something to hide. The purchase took place in 1933, coincidentally the same year as Pelle founded the Silver Legion. Over the next decade, the Stevens, or somebody, plowed today's equivalent of $70 million into the project. It ended up bankrupting them. The Stevenses sold the property in 1948 to millionaire film producer and art collector Huntington Hartford. Hartford hired architect Frank Lloyd Wright to turn it into an artist colony. Who exactly were Norman and Winona Stevens, and what, if any, connection did they have to Pelle or Hitler or anything political? Most obviously, the Stevenses were theosophists, and so was Pelle. Theosophy was a society that combined elements of Western and Eastern mysticism and aspired to become the basis of a new world order. While theosophy wasn't explicitly racist, it held that Aryans were the most spiritually evolved of the Earth's present inhabitants. Theosophists also believed in the coming of the Maitreya, or World Teacher, a Christ-like figure who'd lead humankind into the new order. It wasn't too much of a stretch for some to see Adolf Hitler as the Maitreya. Still, there's no evidence the Stevenses were among them. But it does seem clear that they intended the ranch house to include mystical themes. For instance, they had a large zodiac wheel inlaid in the front hall. While there's just no solid evidence connecting the Stevenses to Pelle or to the Silver Shirts, some interesting people did live just down the canyon. One was Paquita de Shishmaref, who wrote under the pen name Leslie Fry. She was an American who had married a Russian aristocrat killed in the Revolution. That left her with an abiding hatred of Bolsheviks and Jews, just like Pelle. Fry was a tireless promoter of an anti-Jewish hoax known as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. She even claimed to be the person who first put the protocols in the hands of car maker Henry Ford. Paquita Shishmaref had two sons, Michael and Kirill, who shared her views. Kirill definitely knew Pelle when both were scriptwriters in Hollywood. Kirill might also have joined the Silver Shirts. In 1934, Kirill's brother Michael wrote a book praising the Third Reich titled Hitler's Wonderland. That title has inspired imaginative types, who never bothered to read the book, to draw a connection with Wonderland Drive in the nearby Hollywood Hills, a street made infamous by grisly drug-related murders in 1981. And so, more leaps of imagination turned Murphy's Ranch into a home away from home for Hitler. Still, there might be something to the Stevens-Fry-Pelly connection. Right next to the ranch property was the posh headquarters of the Uplifters Club, an invitation-only men's club, i.e., a secret society, founded in 1913 by another rich guy, Harry Haldeman, who was, yes, grandfather of President Richard Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman. The Uplifters were the Los Angeles version of San Francisco's elite and reclusive bohemian club, the object of more conspiracy theories than you can shake a stick at. The Uplifters attracted most of their members from the Hollywood crowd, among them several members of the Silvershirts. Kirill Deshishmaref was another. William Paley was supposedly a member at some point, which makes one wonder if the ranch wasn't somehow connected to the Uplifters Club. The best bet is that the Stevens couple planned the ranch as a theosophist retreat for the expected Maitreya. As for Paley, he dissolved the Silver Legion in 1941, but remained an unrelenting critic of Franklin Roosevelt. After Paley publicly accused the White House of lying about Pearl Harbor, the government struck back. In 1942, he was arrested, tried, and convicted of 12 counts of sedition. Paley received 15 years in prison, but was released in 1950. The terms of his parole forbade Paley from engaging in political activity. So, he repackaged his mystical ideas into a mail-order religion dubbed Soulcraft. It was basically theosophy mixed with spiritualist Christianity. Paley even latched onto the new flying saucer craze and turned his ascended masters into Aryan space brothers. Soulcraft pretty much fizzled after Paley's death in 1965, but it's still around today. Even Paley's colorful career pales beside that of our last example, Francis Parker Yockey. Yockey again shows the strange amalgam of secret societies, political extremism, and occult philosophy. Oh, and espionage. Born in Chicago in 1917 to educated, well-to-do parents, Francis Yockey was, in most outward respects, a typical American boy. But he developed a deep hatred for his native country and everything it stood for. In that, Yockey reflected something commonplace among secret societies and those attracted to them. Contrarianism, a festering dissatisfaction with the way things are and a desire to change them. At its root is the feeling that the present order denies them the power or status they believe they deserve. A book that deeply influenced Francis Yockey was German author Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West. Yockey was struck by Spengler's contention that Western civilization had entered a degenerate phase that would end in its reformation or destruction. Yockey was also impressed by Spengler's unabashed elitism and the notion that race is more cultural than biological. By the late 1930s, Yockey was drawn to fascism and Nazism. By 1939, he joined the Silvershirts. The FBI had evidence of Yockey addressing a meeting of Paley's group in Chicago that year. It's probably while in the ranks of the Silvershirts that Yockey got his exposure to occult doctrines. For instance, FBI reports noted Yockey's interest in theosophy and in esoteric topics such as cosmic rays and astral projection. There's even a suggestion that Yockey dabbled in ritual magic. At the least, he had a taste for bondage and discipline, with himself in the role of master. What everyone seems to agree on was that Yockey was highly intelligent. He studied law and graduated cum laude from Notre Dame in 1941. Given his ideological stance, Yockey was not a supporter of America's war with the Axis powers, and he faked mental illness to avoid the draft. In 1946, Yaki went to work for the U.S. War Department as an attorney involved in war crimes prosecutions. That took him to post-war Germany, where he was put to work reviewing materials used in the Nuremberg trials. Yaki's secret aim was to find errors in the prosecutions and loopholes for the defense. He might have fed such information to another secret society, the underground of Nazi sympathizers in occupied Germany. Yaki was soon fired from his post, basically because he abandoned it. In 1948, Yaki resurfaced in Ireland, where he wrote his magnum opus, Imperium, The Philosophy of History and Politics. In essence, Yaki echoed Spengler's criticisms of rationalism, liberalism, and materialism. But Yaki believed that Americanism embodied the worst aspects of all. He wanted to preserve and restore the supremacy of high European culture. The book got little attention outside the post-war fascist underground. But to some there, it became a kind of Bible. In the post-war years, Yaki threw himself into a variety of secret and open organizations. One was the European Liberation Front that appeared in 1949. He made contact with former members of the German SS and with British fascist leader Oswald Mosley. Mosley was trying to retool his old British Union of Fascists into a new union movement. Yaki signed on as a secret agent of Mosley's European Contact Section. That sought to establish cooperation with neo-fascist cells across Europe. The problem was that many fascists distrusted Yaki, and for good reason. Besides being an American, he also had contacts with communist agents. Yaki had briefly flirted with communism back in the 1930s. He now believed that Stalin had freed the Soviet Union from Jewish influence. During the 50s, Yaki traveled constantly and mysteriously. In 1952, he appeared behind the Iron Curtain to watch the purge trial of 11 Czech Jewish communists in Prague. Some, including the FBI, suspected he might have been recruited by Soviet intelligence. Yaki envisioned a fascist, communist, or black-red alliance against so-called Americanism. Only Soviet Russia, he claimed, had the power to combat the United States. For the time being, anyway. Between 1953 and 58, Yaki made trips to East Germany, and maybe even to Moscow. In search of more allies, Yaki also went to the Middle East. In 1953, he appeared in Egypt, where Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser had just taken control. Yaki wrote anti-Israeli broadsides for Nasser's propaganda ministry. While in Cairo, Yaki made contact with someone else, the Pan-Islamist Muslim Brotherhood. They despised Jews and Americans, but also Nasser and high European culture. The FBI and other U.S. agencies didn't ignore Yaki, but like everyone else, they had a hard time pinning him down. In 1960, Yaki's luck finally ran out. Coming into San Francisco Airport, his luggage was diverted. Officials discovered a trove of fake passports and other documents inside. The FBI nabbed Yaki. While in lockup, he was visited by another American rightist named Willis Cardo. Cardo was one of those inspired by Yaki's Imperium. Cardo ran a publishing house called Noontide Press that churned out white nationalist and Holocaust denial literature. He also formed a group called Liberty Lobby. But before he could be interrogated, Yaki killed himself with a cyanide capsule hidden in his shoe. Who gave it to him, we'll never know. In a note, Yaki claimed he died to protect his brothers in the secret underground. As for Willis Cardo, well, he and Liberty Lobby went on to influence Robert J. Matthews, the founder of the secret society The Order, the killers of Alan Berg. You see, everything connects to everything else. So we've come to the end of our series. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you found it thought-provoking. I hope it makes you want to learn more. As we've seen, secret societies come in many shapes and sizes, but their basic goals are always the same: to enlighten and empower their members. Their influence might be great or small, and for better or for worse, but the world we know today wouldn't be the same without them. Finally, I guess it's fair to ask what I think is the most important secret society. Why, the one that's managed to remain secret, of course.